Welcome back to Midweek Mysticism, the Zohar. It's great to be studying, and I thought we would open up with a brief meta conversation related to Peter's email, which I apologize for ignoring. Not ignoring, I don't have a good answer for it, but I thought let's open it up. And I believe that from somewhere, the question is, why is the language of the Zohar so prosaic? Or like, why does it take, it takes language that is ostensibly about one thing, and it makes it about things that are entirely other. Is that, or do you want to define your question
It's just
better?
so hard to decode. Yes, thank you for remembering the question, and whatever wisdom you can offer on it, I'm really grateful for.
Can I just ask before you, how pertinent was the word Baroque? Because you put that in quotes in your question, because
I put it in quotes because it wasn't intended to be a technical term, only to just say
so
it's.
we art history people read that as like I thought, because there is anyway, so yeah.
No, it was not intended to be a wise or thoughtful use of the word, just a sloppy use.
Does anyone have thoughts? I have some thoughts, but I didn't know if anyone has
Well, you
thoughts.
talked about, this is esoteric stuff that they wanted to keep esoteric. I do find it frustrating, like Peter, this is that and that is that. And I have to look at Matt at the bottom to know that this is that. Nothing is what it seems, but maybe that's part of the point.
Right. So I think, a few things. One is just the esoteric thing, right? You just want to keep the tradition discreet. And the best way to do that, or to really only allow those people who are capable of understanding it to understand it, is to make a cipher. And it doesn't seem like this is, what Rabbi Professor Shaul Lieberman would have called an asmachta, right? I think he did all the glorious research on that in terms of the Talmud and when the drashot, when the rabbinic learnings are really not legitimate at all. I think there's a passage in one of his seminal essays where he says it would have been quite odd if the rabbis read the verse and came up with the sermon in the Talmud. And you really thought that that's how they were reading the verse. It was a memorial device to help pin. And I think he had a fairly maximalist understanding that many, if not most, of the teachings of the Talmud were really not legitimate or bona fide. They were hooks to remember an oral law. So part of the question, your question, I think goes to a comparable question with the Zohar. Are these drashot sermons or homilies deriving as a legitimate interpretation of the text, albeit far flung? Or are they teachings that existed that they were looking to pin back, mystical teachings that existed that they were looking to code and have a way for people to remember? It seems that at least the self-reflective way in which the mystics define their own teaching about this is that of the kind of pardes system, where there's pshat, there's the plain meaning and hints, etc., and this is the sod. And so at least the professed understanding of this is in fact the real secret mystical understanding of the verses. I think I would add to that that everyone I've ever spoken to who claims to be an expert in this stuff, academically or religiously, thinks that they were engaged in using psychedelics or being out in nature in meditative trance states or reciting mantras, or the technologies vary, but that this was some legitimate kind of mystical midrash or interpretation or deepened. It's more of a midrash than an asmachta, if that makes sense. More of, so given that, I think probably they kind of were ideologically committed to the idea of the Sefirot and of certain divine truths, and also that the divine text was deeper than its plain meaning. And so they just needed to uncover, or in some cases transmit, that understanding. And so once that's the case, I think it becomes easier to understand how, you know, they keep, maybe particularly with like Yeshutzu Amayim, which we did like five different mitzvot on, the, you know, the waters swarmed. They had lots of things in the swarming waters. The study of Torah started with, and then we had procreation, and then we had circumcision, and the birds flying above were angels. They were holy souls. They were Elijah the prophet. There were all kinds of, and a lot of it related to Yishritzu. Yishritzu. You almost imagine someone sitting there in a meditative trance and saying Yishritzu for 3 hours in a row, and then recording afterwards all the things that came to mind as they thought about all the things that swarm below that create something on high. So those ideas probably existed, but were triggered. They probably had an idea that circumcision transmitted to them, maybe even that circumcision did this stuff with Elijah. There's like a tradition about that. But then what they were able to do is kind of connect that to say, this verse is actually talking about that, and that's its secret meaning. So I don't know. I didn't write the Zohar. I know that. But I have to imagine something like that is part of how a lot of it was composed. That
is helpful. Yes. Thanks. Thanks for struggling with it.
And if I could just tag on to Peter's question, since we're zooming back for a moment, just tell us on one foot. So then what grabs you about this esoteric, convoluted literature? Significance? Why are you studying the Zohar?
Yeah, so a few reasons. One is it's creativity. I'm a junkie for creativity. I just love creative ideas. And I think it's remarkable that this text, it reads almost as creatively today as it does almost 1,000 years ago.
If not more so.
And I love the way that they hold in tension different currents of Jewish thought and amalgamate them seamlessly. Almost in the same way I love Tanakh for doing that, taking different strands of religious philosophy and ideas and incorporating them in the form of a narrative or legal codes in ways that are making all kinds of comparative and implicit comments about things. Like, the more you know, the more exciting it is for Tanakh. There's intertextual connections and other things. So the Zohar is doing that, but it's doing it with Tanakh, with Midrash, with Aristotle, with the Heichalot school, with Neoplatonic schools of thought. And so they're taking all these religious ideas and kind of like using them, almost like a good music artist who defies genre. So I think that is it's just kind of beautiful to watch. But I think also the experiential element. I know for me, the Zohar is one of those texts, and maybe the Tanakh is too, I would say. Those may be the big two for me, that if I study them, I feel usually challenged and or inspired. The Zohar, I think inspiration in particular, leaves with a kind of buzz for me. A feeling like, wow, something to chew on, to reflect on, that pushes even my own discourse further than it had gone. It's a really daring text for me in terms of the questions it's willing to raise and ask, the sacred cows it's willing to, you know. For example, the golden calf, they have that being like quasi-divine, speaking of sacred cows. So I don't know, for me, but man, if anyone else has thoughts, you know, why are you here? I'm not asking anyone to leave.
Can I just say too, I mean, because I know you didn't mean it this way, but the Baroque thing did strike me just because like Baroque is like interesting, like it emerges out of kind of the Iberian interaction with the New World and with India and the cat. It basically comes out of the Catholic Church, where they need to layer on all these new ornation to kind of the architecture and the art. And it's like 14th, 15th, 16th centuries. I'm like way out of my depth talking about this, but I had to do a little bit of study on this. And I did a series about Native Americans a couple of years ago. And a lot of Baroque, sort of the way it's interpreted now, is a lot of the inspiration came from the early interactions with New World peoples and the kind of elaborate mythologies and artistic traditions that they had, and kind of reading that back into European stuff. And that it's sort of that mixing, or seeing this kind of mythology leads to this need to create these new ornate styles and kind of flourishing on top of stuff. So like bloody crucifixes and stuff like that comes out of the Baroque, and like the really ornate kind of cathedral sort of stuff, like that sort of starts to come out of it. So I, you know, reading it back and just maybe overreading your term into that, it was interesting because it was like, from, you know, the mixing of like intellectual traditions or something like that, is there something there where these teachings become critical at this point? Because it's around the same time, right? The Zohar emerges around the 12th and 13th century, so actually probably even earlier than what we would call the Baroque. So I don't know if any of it has to do with that, like in a need to put a more elaborate ornation on top of the basic like Torah texts and things like that, so people can have like a deeper connection or sort of emotional kind of understanding or of what's going on.
I will add two things with Joe's comments kind of standing as a very useful historical perspective, and I think that sounds true. The Zohar is interesting to me because so many of our customs derive from, even just in this Hakdama, we've seen so many practices of liturgy, of common practice, the Brit Milah, the way we pray on Shabbat, the way Kiddush is arranged, holding the Kiddush cup from the bottom. Like, so many of the practices of modern Jewish life emerge from Zoharic commentary, and the practices remain, but the, like, no one knows why they do. If you make a list of things we do because the Zohar says to do them that way and has a really beautiful explanation of it, or ornate explanation of it, it'd be a long list. Maybe we should keep that list as we do that. You know, it would be a very long list. And so it's useful as an explanatory for why we do what we do, at least at the beginning. Also, there is a section, the Idra Rabba, and I keep toying with whether after our Hakdama we should jump there, the most cryptic section of the Zohar, which is also the most beautiful, I think, that really questions Judaism and universalism. I mean, that's the theory of it, and whether... I mean, the subject is whether kind of Christian critiques of Judaism are somewhat accurate in their description of Judaism as too harsh and not universal enough. And the conclusion is sort of yes. and they're interested, therefore, in reforming Judaism a little bit to be more in line with a more loving, more merciful God. And how would they do that? And they call an emergency assembly to consider. You know, headed by Shimon Bar Yochai. So just that one section of the Zohar alone is interesting. It's significant enough.
If I could respond a tiny bit to Joe's really interesting comments. At various times in our study here, we've been comparing and contrasting this view of existence with that of Maimonides. And it seems more and more to me that this is doubling down and doubling down on the doubling down on an argument with Rambam, because he was such an austere monotheist. And this is the most flagrant flouting of the arch monotheistic strictures against describing God, against talking about any kinds of detail or any kinds of personality or character. Mm. So it seems to be part of a polemic, an intra-Jewish polemic, but maybe motivated by living amongst Muslims. So throw that out there in case that's helpful.
It's interesting, but if you read Mishneh Torah, like the book of, like the beginning of the book of Da, like Mishneh Torah, I think it's fairly consistent with all this stuff. He starts off Mishneh Torah with a whole bunch of things about angels and kind of the depths of secrets and things that, but in a lot of ways, I can't remember the exact language he uses, but I remember it's like, effectively is like, but we can't really talk about that here. We'll talk, you know, you'll need to, you know, go find a mystic to go kind of really get into that. So, but I think, yeah, point taken on that for sure. And also on Rabbi Dollinger's point too, just even like last session, the amount of things that are in the chair of Elijah, the Santandar, like all the things that happened in the circumcision that I'm like, well, this is what we do. So I was thinking the last session, like, for these things about the circumcision, these traditions, my thought was like, do the traditions predate this text, or did the text inspire the traditions? Did the traditions change after 1300 or whenever the, you know, for how we do a circumcision? Because there's like the double circumcision kind of idea too, where there's both the cutting, but also the revelation. And that's what we still do today in most traditional circumcision. So it's, I don't know that there's any good evidence for whether that was there first and then the Zohar became popular and then, or the Zohar became popular and then those traditions were kind of became universalized across the various. So anyway, to your point, Rabbi Dollinger too, about that.
And I think it's a mix. Some of these things, the Zohar is creating a new innovation. Some of them it's a secret mystical tradition about the way the mystics do it, which is different from others. And then some of them is just commenting on the way things are done. Just to the Maimonides point for a moment, I will say, and maybe if we do the Idra Rabbah at some point, which we will, it's in volume 2 of the mat, so we'll get there at one point or another. I mean, there, one of the things they do is they literally describe each sage, each of the major sages takes a term describing a different part of God's face, what his nose looks like, and what the hairs of the beard look like, and what the lips feel like. I mean, it's not anything Maimonides.
This is not Maimonidean at all.
Right.
Though the Lubavitchers want to claim otherwise, but I think that's just because of, as Art Green says, there's this like desire to say everyone's a tzaddik, everyone's righteous, and this like religious idea that they want to not have conflicts. But the truth is, you know, there was great conflict.
So if we're reflecting on the reflection, so the comment, your comment about creativity and Joe's comment about Baroque and bringing all these things together and the conflict between the thinking of Maimonides and the thinking of the Zohar makes me think as an educator about, you know, there's the left brain people and the right brain people. Mm. The divergent creative thinkers, and then there are the linear thinkers. And I'm wondering if, you know, we can see this both historically, politically, but we could also see it psychologically. You know, there are different ways our brains perceive the world, religious truth in general. There's the, okay, everything's in a system, and even, you know, as Joe says, the beginning of Maimonides is philosophical, but it's A, B, C, D in a straight line. And this is, you know, it's like this. That's what we started. It's divergent and creative and Baroque-like and, you know, bringing together diverse traditions in some creative way, not, you know, put them, like, go outline it. That wouldn't work in the Zohar's thinking. So it's also a conflict in, you know, polemics, but it's also, I would say, an inner brain conflict of how do we perceive the world, truth, reality.
Right. Like, you know, to the extent that lefties and those who are ambidextrous tend to be more opposite brained than not, you'd almost wonder, you know, was this written primarily by lefties?
Yeah.
Like, That's a fascinating lens, for sure. Also true, and that's a nice way of making it good that all of it is part of the tradition, that the whole debate and canon.
Yeah.
Notwithstanding that, though, we will...
now let's jump back into the text.
Yeah, but your point is good. And maybe this is the final... Well, there's no final, but... the Zohar really rejects systematization such that even the Mad and subsequent Lurianic attempts to kind of define the Zohar in spheriotic terms actually kind of represent a reduction of the Zohar in ways the Zohar was specifically, like, they could have just given you the spherot and you could work it out. They're trying to do something else.
Oh, there you go.
Do we have the screen sharing up? Okay. So I believe we were just about done with the eighth commandment. Did we finish it or no?
My mark is we were at the paragraph that says countless other concealed rooms. We hadn't done that. We had done up to that paragraph. Great.
Countless other concealed. So we're discussing conversion following circumcision, and we're reminding ourselves that this is the eighth kind of emanated principle, and that in addition to Israel having these kind of special souls, others in the world can join into this system to a point. Some are close, either be Yehuda or be Yehusa. It's a Girsa debate. It's a textual debate in the texts of the Zohar. The main one is be Yehuda in unity. So there are some other nations closely related to Israel in unity. That's an understanding that both Christianity and Islam tend to be monotheistic. But the mat goes with the rarer manuscript of be Yehusa, closely related to Israel, which also exists, implying that, you know, the prototypical founder of Christianity is Edom, which goes back to Esav, who's, you know, related to Yaakov. And so it's an offshoot from the family. And similarly, Yishmael is an offshoot, with Yitzchak. And so depends how you want to read that, if it's about theology or ethnicity, either way. Okay, now countless other concealed rooms, meaning in addition to Ammon and Moab, Christianity and Islam, the Zohar doesn't name Christianity and Islam for obvious reasons. It can't single those out as being kind of having a slightly special space within the conversion palace, but that in and of itself is interesting. Countless other concealed rooms and palaces abide in each wing. And for more on that idea, I would say, again, Reuven Kimmelman's work on the Chadodi, on the line Yaminus Multifrotzi, left and right, they shall spread, about how he feels that Alcabetz was specifically writing about Islam and Christianity in a praiseworthy way as close offshoots of Judaism that both had Sabbaths, just one to the right on Sunday and one to the left on Friday, are Viat Hashem Ta'aritzi, but our Shabbat is on Saturday, implying it has all the benefits of the Christian Sabbath of love and the Muslim Sabbath, which is too strict. It's balanced, right? There's a kind of mystical theological idea about Christian and Islam and the Kabbalists, which is kind of positive, even as it's negative, that continues. Reuven Kimmelman documents that, you know, extensively with every source, and there's 1,000 other sources. So you see there if you like. Countless other concealed rooms and places abide in each wing, from which spirits emerge to be distributed to all converting converts. So this is part of an idea manifest in a halachic tradition that when someone chooses to be Jewish, they're like given new parents, as it were. You know, Abraham is their parent now, and their parents are no longer their parents, kind of a thing, which is sometimes not a popular way. I don't think most people think about it like that. And it would be weird ethically if they did. It would be horrible. But still, there's an idea, which the Lurianic Kabbalists picked up even further, that you get a different soul. So there's a soul swap that occurs. It's not just a legal status. They're called souls of the living being. Now, it's interesting because Maimonides, while we're doing the comparison, in his, do people know about Maimonides' famous letter to Ovadia the convert? So he wrote a letter, and Ovadia the convert, I believe, has asked, when I pray the Amidah, should I say Elohe Abraham, Elohe Yitzchak, Elohe Yaakov? After all, they're not my parents. And Maimonides very lovingly talks about how they're just as much your parent as my parent, you know, theologically, right? It's about theology. Well, here, it's not about theology. It's about the soul. Or it's not that you've shared, but it's, you got a new soul, and that soul is a Jewish soul now, which is related. And what makes it Jewish? It's related to this kind of trunk of the tree a little bit. It's related to this, the emanation of God. They all enter beneath the wings of the Shekhinah, no further. So this takes a new spin on Tachat Kanfei HaShekhinah, a phrase from Ruth, right? That a convert enters underneath. Now, normally the metaphor of underneath the wings of a divine bird, as it were, signal protection. But here it signals to this point and not further, just under the wings. So it is under the wings. It's in the lowest sphere, kind of a Shekhinah, but it is not higher. As for Israel, their soul emerges from the trunk of that tree, and the trunk represents Tiferet, right, which is the thing which all the branches stem from, Chesed, Gevura, Netzach, Hod, and Yesod kind of being maybe the roots in this metaphor. So when souls fly into earth, even this imagery is interesting, the souls flying into earth, into her womb, deep within. Now, notice the earth here is Shekhinah, and she's definitely a woman, and she's a pregnant woman. So you have these souls flying from above and becoming like gestated in Shekhinah, the daughter of Bina, was a pregnant woman. The secret is you shall be an earth of delight from Malachi. So Israel, no, let's focus on that for a second. The secret is you shall be an earth of delight. That's a sod, a secret. What is the secret exactly? You shall be an earth of delight from Malachi. I don't know if we should go to the Tanakh. We should go open it up just on my phone. So in the last chapter of Malachi, the this is the end of a parsha, of a paragraph. Where God says, you know, if you tithe, I'll read just for context. Have you at Kalam Aser al Beta Utsarbi Tarf Beveti, Vichanuni na bazot amar Hashem tzvakot, imdo avtach lechem et arubot ashamayim vaharikoti lechem brachad blidai. Bring the full tithe into the storehouse and let there be food in my house, and thus put me to the test, said the Lord of hosts. One of the few times where God explicitly says to test God. I will surely open the floodgates of the sky for you and pour down brachad blidai, which becomes a paradigmatic. All of the mikubalim will use this formulation for their blessings of individuals to give people bracha, blessing ad blidai, with no end. So if we tithe, God will bless us with abundance. And I will banish the locusts from you so they will not destroy the yield of your soil. And your vines in the field will not miscarry. Notice that already the Tanakh is working with the metaphor of pregnancy. The vines won't miscarry. the grapevines won't have miscarriages. That's a rather jarring, metaphor. Vishru etchem kol ha'goyim, and all the nations will ishru etchem. So this is the heath eel of asher, of fortunate. All of the nations will cause you to be, will render you happy. That's the, here the JTS translation, the old 1917. All of the nations shall account you happy. For you shall be the most desired of lands, says Amar Hashem Tzvakot, says the Lord of hosts. So the context is always useful. So the, oh no. So what's the secret?
So is that saying that, are we saying that the miser, El Beit HaOtzar, the tithes of the storehouse in Malachi, is that, are we saying the souls of converts? Is that what the analogy is there?
Right. So here we have a pro conversion idea, and it seems to be as follows. If we tithe, if we do what we're supposed to do and do religion the right way, it will be so desirable that it will be an Eretz Chepetz. The Shechina is the land, and the Shechina will be so desirable that everyone will want to convert, and there will be no miscarriages, right? Even the Tanakh is working with that theme of the vine, right? And the vine is, of course, produces wine for blessing, as we saw in the very beginning of the Zohar, which is already alluded to in Tanakh. So the secret idea here is, like, we actually, through a more subtle, through example and not force, should want to be the desired conversion object of the others. That's the secret. You see why that's a secret in like the 1200s in Spain. Right? Not just we want to not die. We want you. We're the better religion. Our God is the God of desire. You should want to convert to us if we're doing this right. But then there's this other idea that, like, it's dependent on us. So Israel is a precious son for whom her innards yearn. Right? This is playing on, Ben Yakir, the notion of Ephraim and the prophets as a precious son. Hamu me'aylo, which finds its most beautiful expression in the tefillah of the Amim Noraim of Rosh Hashanah, right? So here, hamu me'aylo, who are her innards that yearn for Israel, which is kind of like Shechina? Like, whose innards are yearning for it? The mat note.
Well, Hashem, right?
Right. But meaning which, I'll just read it. And they are called born from the womb, not from the wings outside. So there's this idea, establishing a hierarchy, that Israel is born from the womb. And what's the womb? The womb is Shechina, but what's the womb of Shechina? Bina, right? Everything kind of emerges from Bina, like that's the divine womb of even of divinity. And so Israel, which is rooted even in Tiferet, right? Bina, like upper energies, the most exalted energies yearn for manifestation of Israel, which is reflective on this earth of something much higher and of God and of the Torah. This is kind of that idea that Israel, God, and the Torah are one. That's all Tiferet. But they, the non-Jewish converts, come under the wings of Shechina. to Eretz Chifetz, to a land of desire. They come just under this. And so we always have a kind of special relationship to God, the most special relationship, with some special rooms for Christians and Muslims, Ammonites and Moabites, that are yet more than, I don't know, Americans who of no religion or something.
So this isn't wholeheartedly pro-con. I mean, it's pro-convert. Join us, but you only get to sit under the wing, and we're from the root and the...
Right, so the Zohar's position on converts, you know, people always describe this in ways that I think don't do it enough justice, good and bad. People describe the Zohar as having a hierarchy, to the extent they describe it, of saying that even converts are not fully the same as born Jews. And it's viewed as an anti-conversion. That's the way it's frequently described by critics. I would just add to that, on the other side of the ledger, it describes conversion as loving the convert is a commandment, but it goes beyond and says that one shouldn't just love a convert, but one should encourage conversion nearly. It basically, that's the secret. It won't quite say, but it hints to with verses, right? So it encourages conversion as a mitzvah and sees in its mystical vision that is a messianic reality that we should encourage quietly. But maybe that quietly is just for pragmatic reasons. But it also then does do what the critics say it does, which is it doesn't quite let the converts be fully Jewish. Mystically. Furthermore, converts have no share in the celestial tree, certainly not its trunk. Rather, their share is in the wings, no higher. Convert is beneath the wings of the Shechina, no higher. They're converts of righteousness. Now, the understanding of tzedek is Shechina, because Shechina is always the one that does equity, reward, punishment, and righteousness is about that. They're converts of the Shechina, literally. They convert only to the Shechina, for they dwell, uniting not within, as explained. So let the earth bring forth souls of the living being according to their kind. So this gets to the Peter Salston question. Now we read it back into the text. You know, when Totsei Ha'aretz Nefesh Chaya Liminehem, or whatever it says. Right, according to their kind. Which kind? Cattle, crawling things, and living creatures of the earth, according to their kind. All of them draw a soul from that living being, but each according to his kind, fittingly. When Breshit orders things according to his kind repeatedly, what they're saying is everything has a role, and in that role, there are hierarchies. It's not an egalitarian role for everything. And so that is a kind of code to say all of the souls come down according to their kind. Some souls are higher than other souls. And within the mystical idea, Moses' soul is higher than other souls, and Shimon Bar Yochai's soul is even higher than Moses' soul in its reaching.
Can I ask a question about this hierarchy?
Yeah.
At the risk of being overly literal about the image, I'm trying to understand that the converts are under the wings of the Shekhinah. They can't go higher, but Israel goes down into the earth. Normally, the hierarchies are mapped onto up is higher, and if you can't get above the wings, that fits with that. But what's being played with the vertical metaphor?
Right, deep within the earth. And if we're getting right, that emerges from the trunk of the tree when souls fly into the earth, into her womb, deep within. So some of the Lorianic commentators comment about this, that if you view this as a practice guide for you as well, that they imagine transcendence first happening, and they have different verses to quote this, as an internal process, transcendence being an internal process, meaning one first needs to turn in and deep within themselves. If one, and the Hasidim maybe even did this the most, if one would try and engage in, for example, like asceticism or self-abrogation or self-flagellation or some of these things that like Hasidei Ashkenaz were into, whipping themselves in ice baths or whatever to like, that's not the path being urged here. The path is an internal one of like knowing oneself. Maybe it's good to talk about this on Heschel's 50th yard site, you know, because I think Heschel was, right, his work, The Prophets, was very much about how the prophets tap into the divine pathos, but they do it each with their individual personality very fully. Like, it's not that they lose their personality, but rather that their personality becomes fiery with the fire of God's emotion, which is God's a way of talking about how God relates to the world. So this is a kind of version of that, that one needs to go deep within the earth to kind of not escape materialism, but to send into the sparks within materialism as a pathway into a portal that gets to the trunk of the tree.
Okay, so this may be a related question, and I'm kind of looking back at Rabbi Kampfer's really helpful Sefirot chart. But so if what we're saying is like basically the sort of native Israel is coming from Bina, it's coming from the womb, are we, I guess, does that, maybe it's kind of like two questions. If we're saying that, does that mean that sort of native Israel is kind of exists between this zone of Keter to Yisod, and the convert is coming from the place of Malchut, which is associated with Shekhinah, and that maybe, are those, maybe a secondary question, are those kind of effectively two different kind of realms? Like the Sefirot from Yisod to Keter are sort of the tree, and Malchut is like the Shekhinah, and they're sort of separate things in this construction.
Well, the Shekhinah is the fruit in the tree metaphor. The apple and the later mystics, Tapuchin Kadishin, the obsession, holy apples. So in part, the answer is, remember, this is a theory of emanation. So there is no difference at some level. It's all a way of things emanating. This is a kind of description of hierarchies, which may be partially illusory, you know, at all. But in the metaphor, usually the fruit of the tree is the Shekhinah, if that helps. It's not here. I think I will name, leaving this, that I have some ambivalence, some serious ambivalence about, you know, how much we want it. I would not emphasize this teaching if we weren't doing an exhaustive study of the Zohar, because I don't know that, like, unless you're some kind of ideologically committed mystic, that you must believe this system per se, or that every teaching that is particularly worthwhile to maintain the superiority of genetically born Israelites, or if that is a meaningful way to look at it, I think, you know, but it's here. So I think this could be a very painful or hurtful teaching to a lot of people, even as there are some really encouraging and interesting parts of it. Just name that. But we're doing everything in this. I'm just not going to censor the Zohar. The ninth commandment. So now that we've had circumcision, and once we had circumcision, other people have circumcision too, the Geri Tzedek. The ninth commandment, to be generous to the poor, this is what I'll be quoting at the State House very outside, and provide them with food. Now, this is going to be a radical take on the question, what does it mean to be created in the image of God? This is the Zohar's answer. You wouldn't know it, but they're about to answer the question, what does it mean to be created in the image of God? All kinds of answers. Here's the Zohar's answer: to be charitable. For it is written, this is one of those that Rabbi Kampfer could make a poem out of, if he wanted. For it is written, let us make a human being in our image according to our likeness, right? Bitsalmenu kidzmutenu. So this is the key. Bitsalem in our image, kidzmutenu according to our likeness. Now, who is speaking here? Okay, well, let me read the teaching and then I'll tell you. Let us make a human being jointly, including male and female. So this relates to the rabbinic tradition that already in the early Midrash that, and in the Talmud too, that Adam HaRishon was an androgynous, right? It was a due part Sufim, facing back to back a man on one side and a woman on the other. And of course, the Kabbalists make a lot of the Nesira of God's surgery to decouple Adam and then Eve. But here they're joined in our image, the wealthy, according to our likeness, mystery of the poor. For the wealthy derived from the side of the male, the poor from the side of the female, just as they constitute a single. Whoa, what happened?
You've gone to the Kindle store.
I thought we were reading the Zohar. What happened to it? Did my book expire or something? All right. Hold on.
There we go.
The wealthy, according to our likeness, mystery of the poor. For the wealthy derived from the side of the male, the poor from the side of the female. Just as they constitute a single partnership, one caring for the other, providing for the other, and rendering goodness, so should human beings below be rich and poor in a single bond, one providing for the other and rendering goodness. So this is really important. God is rich and God is poor. God is male and God is female. People are rich and people are poor. And people have many genders. So the certain things are prompting this. The main textual prompt of this, which the Ari noted, the Arizal, this is a direct comment from the Arizal on this piece of Zohar, but I think it's inherent to the Pshat, the plain meaning of the Zohar, though not stated. And I actually think this is so important, it should be in the map. In fact, maybe I'll write them for the next edition. I suggest they include a footnote noting they don't generally note Kabbalistic commentaries. They note academic commentaries and Girsaot and references. This feels important to me that every other ma'amar, every other statement of creation in the creation account has an amira, a statement, a declaration, and then an asiya, a doing. Vayomer Elohim yehi, or vayehi, or whatever, whatever, and vayas it, whatever, right? And said this, and then he made that. That's the way it happens. But here, it goes straight to Na'ase Adam Bitzalmenu. The Asiya is in the first statement. There's not two statements. There's one statement, and it's the only one where the Asiya is in the very first. It's comes right with this the saying, as opposed to so the Ari understood that all the other things created are created through Havdalah, through separation, but people are created in the image of God because they aren't good or bad. It escapes the gnosis of evil and goodness, but people are both good and bad. And in this way, they're the ultimate manifestation of the original creative emanated energy, which split right and left, but then comes back to the middle. As it were, if you can imagine things splitting male and female and then being created in one androgynous person, things being created, some of them are full of blessing and some of them are tzimtzum or devoid of blessing. And then you get people who are both of them. And so you get people who are oddly like God. So it's not just rich and poor, but all of the rich and poor here is a stand-in for everything that's a dichotomy or differentiated in the sphere becomes undifferentiated again when we come to people. So whole, people are whole, and so they're in the image of God. People are complex, speaking of Baruch, so they're in the image of God. And we do get a wealthy poor thing going on here, where the Shechina is poor and Tiferet is wealthy, where Chesed is wealthy and Gevurah is. But we got a right left and a top down. But in particular, the Shechina we've described as Daleh, as poor before, and we've used Dalit to describe Shechina. Because the Shechina, of course, when divine flow is interrupted, she is in exile, forgotten, barren, and not pregnant. You know, they're different metaphors. And so here, the Na'asa, who's doing the speaking, you know, the answer to the question of like, who's the royal we in the thing, is Na'asa Adam Bitzalmenu, is really like Tiferet and Shechina. Right? Na'asa Adam Bitzalmenu. Kidmutenu. They, the person, the androgynous person, will be rich and poor. Meaning that which we perceive as different, that there are wealthy people and poor people, one of the main divisions, class divisions, is illusory because people are really one unit, descended from one androgynous person. Even the genders, which are society constructs, aren't original, says the Zohar. And they have to be bound together in a single bond, right? In other words, the task then, or the avodah, to be fully human, is to erase the class and gender differences which pervade social constructs. That's, I think, the plain sense of the first paragraph. Trying to not do too much editorializing and just say what it means and embellish it enough to get the sense of it. I might be failing. if anyone wants to. So maybe we'll come back to dominion over the fish, but if anyone, and we'll start there next time, does anyone want to make a comment about this ninth commandment now that we have all these hierarchical differences, is to be in God's image means to have this bond between rich and poor, or maybe all kinds of other differences that emerge to unite and to get all of it in a symbiotic system, rendering goodness. But this kind of explains you need poor people, but those poor people need to be supported in order to actualize the human. And the Ari says you derive all of that, or they derived all of this from the Amira and the Asiya being together. They were understanding that, and from the Na'ase. I don't know if, I think that's a, you know, a prescient observation.
I know it's short on time, but so the last two teachings essentially are, and maybe this is kind of a statement question, but it seems like they're taking elements of society that are marginalized, the convert and the poor person. And there's a level of condescension here, of course, but effectively they're saying that these groups are critical toward, in the eighth commandment, Israel's realization of spiritual grandeur. You need the convert. And then in this, to be a fully realized Adam, or to kind of have that full image in which you were created, you need the poor. So there's a level of condescension, but also sort of these marginalized groups are, and caring for them are kind of critical to your spiritual well-being. Is that kind of an assessment of the?
And the Zohar with the poor in particular, you know, we've seen before with Abraham and his feast, you may remember, and on the holiday, he didn't, the Satan was there and he didn't give the Satan, Abraham didn't give the Satan food, the Zohar mentions. In Parsha Yitro, the Zohar will very grandly say that God is the lawyer for poor people who can't afford legal representation in court hearings in the world to come, and will punish the criminals. You know, so the Zohar I don't know what that stems from. You know, some scholars have written papers about the influence of Christian thinking and a kind of glorification of poverty in the thinking of the Zohar. But there's a very strong, but I think it may just be the sense of Israel in exile, actually, even though this is before the Spanish Gerush Sfarad, you know, for later Kabbalists, that, you know, obviously also debated to what extent it becomes influential, but Gershom Scholem certainly had a lot to say about that. He thought it was crucial. But even in the Zohar, even before the Gerush Sfarad, you see this kind of exilic, the idea of the Shekhinah is poor. They're worried about the flow being interrupted. The mystics are not, if we are not doing what we need to do to bring divine flow into the world, there's going to be like poverty. And so a lot hinges on, but what's interesting here is it translates the act of tzedakah, maybe I'll close on this point, and gives it a mystical kavanah, right? The act of charity now, which is so basic ethically, is now not just an ethical thing, but giving charity is a way of unifying, ending the exile and unifying the design and allowing both parties to become fully human, right? The poor and the rich, and it's bridging bonds, a chasm, you know, it's the ultimate yichud. And by the way, this is like almost the last one. Now we get to others, but like this is the end of a series a little bit. So it's kind of an apex. They don't really include the widow and the orphan as much as the convert and the poor. And I always wonder, you know, the Tanakh categories are like Ani, Ger, Yatom, and Almana, I think are kind of the big ones. We've got the Ger Tzedek, we've got the Ani, the poor person. We don't really have the widow and orphan. And I wonder if that's because they were men. I don't know. Enough of my historicization and whatnot. So, thank you all for return to the Zohar. Well, next time we'll finish Commandment 9. 10, 11, and 12 are pretty short. We may, I imagine, two more sessions for the Hakdamah, 2 to 3 more sessions and Hakdamah. And then do some thinking about, do you want to then jump into Bereshit? Then we go Parsha by Parsha. We go straight to the Zohar commentary. Or do we want to jump to the Idra Zuta or Rabbah, some of the kind of the two other sections of the Zohar, which are really pretty distinct and not Parshanut? And do something, you know, grand and thematic? Or do we want to go Parsha by Parsha? And when we get there, we'll get there. So that's up to people. But I had in mind we'll just go in order, but I'm open to doing the Idras, which are the most cryptic mystical texts ever written in anything. Open to trying them. All right. Thank you all.
All right. Good luck bringing the Zohar to the public.
But yeah. So what? Wait. What are you going to teach? What? What was the? You have to give us the punchline. What was the? What's the verse you're going to use in your benediction?
Poor. Oh no! Just that the Zohar says that being created in the giving charity to the poor is what it means to be created in the image of God.
Gotcha.
I think that is a teaching. Is, you know, that's a quotable. You can make a meme about that. The, you know, we're talking. We're thinking. No, giving charity is what makes people human. And receiving charity. Mm-hmm. It's not just giving for the Zohar. It's a two-way street, actually.